Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Realpolitik, a word I learned in the 20th century, and here we are, the 21st. Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, writing about Realpolitik right now, moving. And I go to an example that appears, "Lost the Plot," goes the headline in the Financial Times, the pink paper out of London. Tony Blair's Gaza role prompts incredulity and some hope. Some in former UK Prime Minister Labour parties react with surprise at his proposed role in Palestinian territory. What role? The President of the United States has asked Mr. Blair to represent everyone's interests as chair of an independent commission that is charged with the rebuilding and re-educating and reawakening of the Gaza Strip following the cessation of violence in the Gaza Strip. And Tony Blair is a seasoned European politician who has had some years now, I understand, in the Middle East, representing interests, both commercial and public interests in the Middle East. So the question here is realpolitik in action. Is this an example? You renovate a man from the 20th century who was successful as labor leader, but who has not been much in the news, at least in London, ever since. The Labour Party now struggles with completely new quandaries with its overwhelming majority, and I don't remember them celebrating Mr. Blair. Gregory, is Tony Blair realpolitik? Does that make sense? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. No, I don't think it does. I think Tony Blair epitomizes what I call surreal politic, in which they or pseudo real politic. He thinks he is the lean, hard practitioner of real politic, which is supposedly the cool and dispassionate assessment and management of strategic situations and geopolitical situations. And certainly, Tony Blair was not an exemplar of that. He did portray himself as a pragmatist, but in fact, you know, he's still, if you like, dodging war crimes allegations, which were quite valid, actually. The fact that he broke a lot of international and national conventions on war crimes when he was Prime Minister of Great Britain. And in fact, he caused a lot of the problems which the Labour government is dealing with today, which is by basically attempting to republicanize Great Britain and do away with the traditional strictures of governance, the traditional hierarchy of governance, and he basically dismembered the House of Lords. So I think having Tony Blair in this, if you like, Treaty of Peace for Gaza is almost laughable, and it discredits President Trump enormously. Significantly, and President Trump alluded to this, it wasn't President Trump who went out and sought Tony Blair. Quite the reverse. Tony Blair literally petitioned Trump for this job and may have actually suggested a framework in which he would play a role, and whether that's a leading role remains to be seen. But what we have seen of Tony Blair is that he has used his position to avoid, if you like, political and legal responsibility for his actions in the past, but also to make large amounts of money for himself and his family. So I think President Trump would be well advised to minimize the role in this Gaza management board for Tony Blair, if it's to have any credibility whatsoever. He's known as being basically looking after his own, feathering his own nest in all of these things. And he is pragmatic only in the sense that he looks after his own interests and not that of his country or his constituents.
We know very little of the deal. There's published points, 20 points, I believe. But we know very little about what it will look like, when the fighting stops, if the fighting stops. What I haven't heard or seen since the announcement is any roadblock that looks impossible to move. So there's momentum here. Is that realpolitik, all these different factions coming together to agree upon something that ordinarily on any afternoon they would have rejected?
Well, again, it's the passage of time. I think that, yes, the interesting thing is that Qatar, which has been the great proponent of Muslim Brotherhood, which means that they supported Hamas, which is a Muslim Brotherhood organization. The fact that Qatar supports this new treaty of peace for Gaza is very, very significant. The real opponent of it will have to be Turkey. Turkey might stay silent for the time being on it, but Turkey's long-term goal is to oppose and destroy Israel and to restore Turkish dominations over the entirety of the Levant and, if possible, into Arabia itself, which it had under the Ottoman Empire years or a century or more ago. Turkey's attempt to emplace the new government in Syria, for example, was in the hope that essentially that would become Turkish territory in all but name. And that's not going too well for Turkey. But Turkey is not going to give up on this. Turkey is the big fly in the ointment. But in the meantime, if you've got this situation with the US, Saudi Arabia, UAE, possibly Bahrain, Jordan, and the like, coming in to support this is going to be very, very significant, because you could see ultimately this great trading region in that area, and including going down to Egypt and into the Red Sea. There's great scope for a new economic growth region to occur there. And as I say, at the moment, Turkey is the major fly in the ointment.
I learned from you that the term itself, realpolitik, from the early part of the 19th century, mid-19th century, a politician named Ludwig von Rockau. However, it dates back to Sun Tzu, to 3,000 years ago. But what is it today, Gregory? Is it pragmatism? Is it accepting limitations? Is it following rules? How do we interpret it today?
Well, the problem is we're not interpreting it today. Everybody thinks now that they're a practitioner of realpolitik because they say they ignore, if you like, the rules of war, the rules of peace, the rules of human society of the past, because they, and that includes religious tenets and the like, because it's too difficult. Nobody wants to go to the trouble of studying and maintaining a discipline which actually gives you what realpolitik is supposed to give you, and that is absolute objectivity when you assess a situation and absolute objectivity when you prosecute your own country's policies. And yes, that aligns to a degree with an America first policy or a China first policy or whatever country is practicing it. But the concern is that realpolitik today represents, you know, I want, therefore I must have, instead of saying, yes, I need this for my country. How is the most pragmatic way I can achieve it without alienating people, without creating unnecessary enemies, without empowering adversary states and the like? And we're not studying this sufficiently. We need to go back. And one of the things I called for in the article was some real discipline in the study of realpolitik as an art form. Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski in the 20th century were viewed themselves as great practitioners of realpolitik, and in fact they only caused a lot of problems, particularly Henry Kissinger, who, for example, ignored the interests of Cyprus and Greece in order to woo the bigger partner at the time, which he thought was Turkey. And what we have today is 75 years or so of problems in Cyprus and in the Eastern Mediterranean caused by Henry Kissinger supporting the Turks in their invasion of Cyprus in 1974.
And therefore, we have no one practicing it. Sometimes I see the attribution to it by decisions that are, what you'd have to say at first glance, contradictory. That is not realpolitik. It's not being practiced. Let me use everything as an example. We have right now the question about who's leading NATO. And if the United States isn't going to lead it, who is? There's no single answer. But the person I would find most attractive to lead NATO would be the bookkeeper in Friedrich Merz. Does he practice realpolitik? He seems bloodless.
He's definitely bloodless, but that doesn't mean dispassionate or objective. He has absolutely failed in his leadership of Germany. And in fact, when you look at it, he's the most unpopular chancellor Germany's had since World War II. And he's attempting to retain his position simply by overriding the public will. So he's not a good practitioner of realpolitik, would not be an ideal leader for NATO. And the question is, what is the purpose of NATO today? We haven't yet really looked into that either. We've seen that people who want to keep NATO going in its 1950s modality are merely the old Cold Warriors who want to define themselves by having a worthy enemy. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, there were a lot of the old Cold Warriors of the left and the right wanted to keep the Cold War alive by repainting post-Soviet Russia as though it were the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Treaty. And it became a very unobjective, unpragmatic approach to pursuing national security for Europe or for the United States or Canada, for that matter. So basically, if we were to practice realpolitik today, it should be to objectively look at the framework and architecture of nations and the factors which go into sustaining its viability. And there are a lot of, if you like, subjective aspects to that, and namely individual cultures and nationalities, as well as geopolitical necessities which countries have to abide by. You know, what we see with NATO, what we see with President Trump today insisting that everybody follow the United States line on defense spending, for example, is that it's not taking into account the geographic and geopolitical pressures on individual countries around the world, which may not be the same as those for the United States. So a realistic view, a realpolitik view, would be to understand what various countries need for their own survival and sovereignty and find ways to utilize that reality to build alliances and to build common cause in certain areas of interest, not across the board necessarily. It's as Lord Palmerston said, the former British Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary, he said, Britain does not have permanent friends. It only has permanent interests. And that means that sometimes those interests will clash even with the interests of its friends.
My measure of the English leadership today is that it's a long way from that definition. Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, returning to our favorite moment, the King Charles III report. We're headed to a place I'm unfamiliar with, Barrow-in-Furness.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.